Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Hightower Radio Lowdown. I am Deanna, your friendly neighborhood nerd and occasional sidekick, and I am here to introduce you to our new podcast. This is the Chat and Chew Roundtable, featuring Hightower and some spectacular guests, and this is our first episode. We hope you enjoy.
Howdy-ho, everybody. Jim Hightower here. Welcome to all of you Hightower Lowdown friends and our new subscribers on the Lowdown Substack. Yes, 2 months ago, I didn't know what a Substack was, and now I am one. It's amazing what's happening in America today. So this is our first of many gatherings of Lowdowners and Substackers here at the Chat and Chew Roundtable, otherwise known as My Kitchen Table. Where we talk about the topics of the day and what's going on and what we might do about it, most importantly. So pull up a chair, pour yourself a coffee, a beer, a water, whatever. One of my favorite songs, by the way, is Norman Blake singing Whiskey Before Breakfast. I don't personally participate in that ritual, but nonetheless, it's okay if you want to do that. Everything's okay here. Join our Lowdown conversation. As always, we are taking on the powers that be on behalf of the powers that ought to be, the ordinary workaday stiffs of America. And when I say the powers that be, I'm talking about the six B's, and that would be the bosses, bankers, the billionaires, big shots, bastards, and bullshitters who think they're the top dogs, and we're just a bunch of fire hydrants out here in the countryside. So we try to elevate the countryside, and we bring to the table people who are not just politicians talking about stuff, but people who are doing stuff that needs to be done. And as always, we have with us Deanna Zant. Yes, DZ is with us, coming from Brooklyn, New York, part of our worldwide scream that we represent here on the Hightower Lowdown and Substack. And Deanna, tell us what's going on. What are we doing?
What are we doing? I ask myself that every single day. Hey, Hightower, good morning. We are on the internet, and I just want to let folks know that you can join Hightower's Substack by going to jimhightower.substack.com. There you'll be asked to subscribe. You can get a free subscription, or if you would like to do things like watch us record these things live and many other little perks, you can also upgrade to a paid subscription. And we have a great time. We've got a lot of good content, and we'll see you over at jimhightower.substack.com.
And that's what we've got for you today, a couple of spectacular championship fighters for freedom of speech, basically, in our country. And our topic of the day is, have Americans gone nuts? And we're talking about book banning. Book banning in communities all across this country, big cities, small towns, rural, urban, all across, an assault on our basic right to read and to learn and to explore ideas. And to explore all that with us, we've got the president, national president of the American Library Association, along with the managing director of PEN, which is a great writers organization, freedom of writing, and et cetera, that I'm a part of, by the way. So we're going to welcome them. We're going to start off with Emily Drabinski. Emily is a longtime agitator, dare I say, for the people's cause, working with unions, working with organizing groups, grassroots organizations all across the country. And we find Emily in her old hometown, Boise, Idaho. So welcome, Emily. Glad to have you with us. And let me start with a basic, Emily, because a lot of people, particularly those who might not have been in a library and 40 or 50 years, might wonder, what does a librarian do? Isn't it just, you just check out books? I mean, is that it? Emily.
Thanks, Jim, and thanks for having me. And just to clarify, I'll be president in June. I'm incoming president of the association right now, and so delighted to be joining you from Boise, Idaho, where I grew up, where I spent yesterday visiting my alma mater, Boise High School, the site where I helped organize a walkout against the Iraq War when I was in college. So I appreciate the callback to my lifetime of agitating. So libraries do all kinds of things. We do check out books, and I always like to remind people of that. I love to read, and it's important to have books available for people. But we are also community gathering centers. We do children's story times. We are diaper banks. We help you with your tax form. Think about all the things that require an email address in this country. Accessing, you know, rental assistance programs, accessing Social Security and Medicaid. We offer broadband internet access to people all over the country, as well as the people like me and all of my librarian colleagues who can help you manage the things that you find on the internet. So we've got a lot going on. It's a really exciting sector, and I'm so pleased to be a part of it.
Well, it's really a sort of a community center in my experience. And I do want to give you a little perspective on me. I have, in fact, right here, my Austin Public Library card issued.
Well, that's about the most beautiful library I've ever seen.
Issued. It's gorgeous. Yeah, it is a fabulous. The people here voted, what is it, maybe 10 years ago now, to build a new library right in the center of town. It's a spectacular building, a spectacular scene, and open to all, which is the nature of libraries generally, which is why I make the point that it really is a community center, because a lot of people go there even because it's warm, for example, or they go because,
you know, I live in New York City.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go to the bathroom. There's one place to go to the bathroom in New York City, and it is at the library.
Now there's a public service right there that that isn't touted enough.
And it could have been a parking lot, could have been a jail. Right. Instead, it's a library. Right. Who could be against it?
That's terrific. So I have a long personal history with libraries, and in fact, my father and mother ran the Main Street Newsstand in Denison, Texas, and they sold books. They sold pocketbooks, paperback books in that store. Yet, my father was a big supporter of building a new public library in Denison, Texas, because he felt the community needed it. It was, in fact, competition, I guess you could say, for him, but he didn't see it that way at all. He saw it as a part of the common good that makes a community a community. It brings community together for it. So he was a big supporter of the public library, and then I've had that library card from childhood forward. It was again. We're in Texas, so it's very hot in the summer times, and it was one place that was cool. So we as little tykes could go in there and read a book. It was just terrific. And that experience kind of shaped my awareness of the importance of libraries all the way down the line. And then actually my first job out of college was working for the Congressional Research Service at the Library of Congress, which is a spectacular building and a pretty nice place to work, with access to all sorts of, well, everything basically, and taught me how to do some elemental research, which has benefited me over the years. Libraries are an important part of my life, but I think they're an important part of communities generally. And Emily Drabinski, Wouldn't you say that it is among the most popular, if not the most popular, public institutions that exist in America?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the last ones standing, right? We're looking at more than 40 years of disinvestment in public institutions and public goods. And when you look at the attacks that are happening on libraries right now, they parallel attacks on K-12 education, on higher education. So I think it's important to link what's happening to libraries with what's happening to school curricula, to the privatization of education. But the library enjoys normally a high level of public trust. Like I said, who could be against it? You bring your kid there for story time. There's something for everyone. Everyone is welcome. You can use the bathroom, get a drink of water, stay warm when it's cool and cold when it's hot. So there's a lot to love about the library. And I find that when I tell people I'm a librarian, they love it. They're like so excited because we all have that library story you just told about the time we were a kid. And that was the place that we were able to find ourselves.
I was just going to say that I think everyone I know has that exact story of library as sanctuary, you know, and especially for kids who don't otherwise have access to other parts of culture at home. It was certainly my sanctuary. I'd spend every minute I could in our local library.
Yeah, I mean, I was at Boise High Library yesterday, Boise High School, where I went to school, and the library, I spent the day there. And every time I got back to the library, there was another crop of students, people staring at their phones and ignoring everybody, people talking with one another, kids like tucked away in the back corner. And Natasha Rush, the librarian there, was very clear that for her, making that space for kids who, you know, are subject to the kinds of attacks that we're facing right now, like the desire to eliminate all books about queer life. If you're a queer student, going to the library and sitting and being quiet there is actually, for a lot of people, the only place that can do that. And, you know, it's the librarians who work in those spaces that make it possible for kids to find that home.
And yet, an institution that is, I think, ranking with the post office as by far the most popular, maybe the only two popular public institutions left in America. Yet this institution in every community in America is under attack. Librarians themselves are under attack. I mean, people who are the most helpful, the most community-minded people in our communities are being assaulted as some sort of evil force. It's kind of the new McCarthyism, I guess, but really it's the new hatred bugaboo that we have to have somebody mm-hmm. to hate. And so librarians are being blamed for all sorts of things that don't even exist, for example. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, so let me ask Nadine to come in.
Can I say one other thing about that, Jim, before we move? Just that I think you're right that it's the post office and the public library that are the two most like respected and valued institutions, and two that are under concerted attack by the public. And think about what those two institutions do. They're the two structures that we have in this country that circulate public goods, where you can move things around and you can share things and you can get things from place to place. Mm. And so it's an attack on the sort of circulatory function of society also.
Yeah. Two institutions that actually deliver, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I never thought, but I mean, we've talked and Hightower has written a ton about attacks on the post office, but I never made that connection to the circulatory system of the country.
I'm here to connect you, Deanna. That's why I showed up.
There you go. That's what we tried to do. Connect people together to take on the powers that be that are running roughshod over us, running roughshod over our public libraries, for God's sake. Again, popular institutions, yet under assault. So that goes back to my original question of our presentation here today of, have Americans gone nuts? Or is this just a tiny percentage of political right-wing nutballs who are using the library to weaponize their own political agenda? Let's bring in Nadine to talk with us here a little bit. Nadine Fareed Johnson. By the way, my mother was a Johnson, so we're related, Nadine, somewhere back in there.
That's awesome.
Nadine is the head of Penn. Tell us first just a little bit about what is Penn, P-E-N.
Yes. Thank you. It's so great to be here and to be here with all of you. And Emily, I'm a big fan of yours and of ALA, so it's really a true honor to get to talk with you today. So Penn America, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and we stand at the intersection of literature and human rights to protect free expression in the U.S. and around the world. As you might imagine, our work in the U.S. that has been U.S.-focused has grown exponentially in the past few years because of the very attacks that you are talking about, Jim. We have seen In the past 2 years, we've collected reports of increasing restrictions on books and the freedom to read and learn in classrooms and in school libraries. And as an organization that's committed to free expression and to open access in literature, for the past 100 years, we are 100 years old, 101 actually, we felt compelled to drill down here and see what's happening nationwide, what are these trends, which states are leading the charge, which topics, voices, identities are being erased or being silenced, and just how widespread the censorship has become. And as you note, this is, it really is a question. I've been asked this quite a bit. You know, who's behind this and where do they represent? Like, is this really widespread? And the truth is that it's a little bit of everything, right? It's happening in 32 states. We documented in the last school year. And you're talking about 4 million students are affected by this, which is a not insignificant number of kids who have been told they can't read what they want to read. And I think it's really important to point out, as Emily has, that this is affecting the librarians who are in this service to students, to kids. It's affecting their teachers who have classroom libraries who they've had to empty. It's affecting the parents like me who don't want the government to come in and tell us what we can and can't read. I'd like to parent my own kids and have them be able to have access to information. And if I didn't, I still wouldn't want the government to come in and do it for me. And of course, it's affecting the students. And so we really need to be, I think we really need to be focused on the danger that this causes and that it is causing and the effect that it's having, because it really is sweeping the country.
Yet it's not new.
No.
In fact, Nadine, I think you've got a story on what was the first protest against freedom of speech in the United States.
Before the United States, 1637, Thomas Morton's New English Canon was banned because it was deemed, and I quote, a harsh and heretical critique of the Puritans. And they just couldn't have that. And so
this is my shocked face, y'all. Wow. The Puritans got mad. Wow.
I want to point out the first English settlement in the United States was 1619. So just pretty shortly after the Europeans
they
landed.
They right to work. They were like, you know what? TikTok people, let's start banning things. We got to get a move on.
So it has been throughout our history. But yet, on the bright side, throughout our history, people have fought back, right?
That's exactly right. And I think that's really important to note that we have, we've had this era after era of censorship. We've had, you mentioned the McCarthy era. In the 1970s, actually, this, and this should, I think, resonate with folks. There was quite a movement to ban books from schools in the 1970s. And they were actually started in many faith in parents of ex-state. So Parents of New York United, for example, was one group that wanted to ban several different books in schools. And they took that information. They went to the school board. The school board banned the books. Does it sound familiar? Because exactly what's happening right now.
Right. I was going to say, eerily.
Talk about circular.
I've heard the story.
Exactly. But every time the First Amendment has won out. And I do think that we're in the biggest attack on the First Amendment we've seen in generations. But I do ultimately think that thanks to a group like the ALA and thanks to a group like PEN America and the many, many people who are behind our organizations and the coalition partners that we have, that we will get through this period.
I mean, people talk about, it's like everybody agrees with us, everybody, right? Like ALA numbers demonstrate that you know, it's nonpartisan issue. You know, 80% of people really want books in the library.
Very conservative people agree with us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we had an experience here in Austin a few years ago that I've talked about before in which a Citizens Against Pornography arrived in our town. And the minister, the head of it, rallied people against a movie theater that, in fact, is about four blocks from where I live here in Austin. And he said, pornography. There's pornography being shown in this movie theater. And that's actually true. They were showing X-rated films. And so he went on a crusade how we must shut this down and we must take all the dirty books off of all the magazine racks in town. And he rallied a whole bunch of people. And there was a public hearing at the city council. And the minister made his point. And then up walked, shuffled John Henry Falk, who was about he was 75 or so years old at the time. And John Henry had been a champion of civil liberties. He had been under attack in the McCarthy period. He had been blackballed. He had a national television show that was extremely popular, and he was driven off of that show and out of the performance arts by this hatred. So John Henry Falk was speaking from experience, but he shuffled on up there to the microphone and addressed the citizens against, as well as the city council, and the minister had explained that that lo and behold, after the 5 p.m. show just the week before, a man had come out of the theater and gone into the alley and masturbated right there, and a woman had seen him do that. And this was the horror that that he was trying to defeat. And John Henry, again, shuffled up there and with his one good eye, explained to the assembled group that he in fact had been born and raised about 10 blocks from where that movie theater was. So he said he knew the area well, and he said, but I just want to remind everybody here that there was a great deal of masturbation taking place before there was a pornographic theater there. So that pretty well shut down the hearing, and the Constitution was saved by a story about masturbation. That's a unique part of American history that not everybody knows, but that's what we
only
that's why
in
we
Austin.
Exist to bring these important stories forward. But Emily, you know about a story just about 100 miles from where I'm sitting right now, out in Llano, Texas. Rural town, mm-hmm. Beautiful little town. I've been out there. It's got wineries. It's on the Llano River. Llano, by the way, is a Spanish word that properly is pronounced Llano, but, you know, we do what we've got to do.
Yeah, I had to learn that in the process of prepping for this show. I made the mistake of saying Llano, and
no.
Hightower said,
nobody
no,
knew.
This is Texas.
You,
it's Llano.
Llano, yeah. So, anyway, the good folks out in Llano have a public library system, 3 libraries in this small county out there, only about 10,000 people in the whole county. And so they're going along with their life just fine. But suddenly, Emily, can you just pick up the story there that suddenly the library was under attack?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing we're seeing all over the place, these sort of organized pro-censorship groups that are challenging the right of challenging libraries for having books on their shelves, mostly related to LGBTQ plus experience and the experience of people of color, particularly Black Americans. And so in response to public pressure to remove books from the library, the library director in Llano, they worked to keep the books on the shelf, and the courts agreed with them, and the decision was made to keep the books on the shelf. And then there was an organized effort to defund the library completely because the books were going to remain on the shelves. And that's the trend that we're seeing that I find really alarming, right? It's like, because it can't be about the book, right? Like, it's just anybody who has a kid, right? Nadine, I don't know how old your kids are. Mine's 15. And it, like, the problem with his life is not access to too many library books, right? Like, that's not the problem. Yeah. It's like, he's got a phone in his hand and we're mad about exactly. He might potentially get a book from the library. So what we saw there was then an effort to defund the library altogether. And that's happened in Llano County, but also in Patmos, Michigan, in the entire state of Missouri, where the House of Representatives voted to zero out the budget, state budget for libraries in the entire state, in response to the librarians there activating and organizing to push back against these censorship attempts. So that's what happened in Llano, a huge amount of public pressure and public outcry, and good, solid, on the ground, person-to-person organizing in Llano managed to keep that library open for now while they continue to sort of work through the courts, is what the language is, work through the courts to see if those books will remain on the shelf. So we need that public pressure. We need to be really loud about it. I'm really Like, I'm here in Boise, and I was meeting with librarians yesterday, and they were like, we thought this was only happening in Boise.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, and it's easy when you're in Idaho to think this is an Idaho problem. It's not an Idaho problem. This is a New York State problem also. It's all over the country. But, you know, it's like part, it's like the end game of defunding public institutions that I think we need to really keep our eye on. Because like we said, everybody is in favor of the book being on the shelf. The vast majority of Americans are like in favor of people reading, right? But it gets a little touchier when we say, well, we also want to fund public goods and public institutions.
And I think it's important to note what kind of tactic this is. This is a tactic that was used in the civil rights era. We would rather close down the pool than integrate it racially.
Fill it with concrete. Yep.
Absolutely.
Totally.
I mean, it is, it's a devastating history, and it's not a little bit of irony that this is the type of stuff people want to ban from classrooms, understanding what has come before so we can learn from it. And instead what we're doing is taking these tactics and using it against people, in a way that is incredibly harmful. And my kids are elementary school age, and we use the library all the time.
Oh yeah. Can you imagine buying every single one of those picture
books? My goodness.
You could never do it.
Never do it.
Well, in the Michigan case, I think it is, or maybe it's Missouri, I don't remember, but you know, they've got some like 70,000 books, and there were only 9 that even had the phrase that the objectors were objecting to. So again, this is a problem that does not exist, but they've manufactured
In Boundary County, Idaho, Northern Idaho here, the armed right pushed out the library director there. They were parked in front of her home with guns, the sort of physical threats really intense around a list of books that they didn't want in the library's collection, and the library owned not one single one, which is how you know it's not about the book. Wow. It's about power.
Yeah, and real people are hurt. In the case of Leno, a librarian was fired. Because she refused to take the books off the shelf. So there's nothing wrong with these books. And then a federal judge finally agreed with her. There is nothing wrong with the books, and they have to be put back on the shelf. 17 books we're talking about, you know, in a whole library system that led to this brouhaha. But a important point you were making, Emily, is that people think it's in Llano County, that's the first time they ever heard of this. You know, suddenly they're hit with this. And the same thing in Boise, or same thing in Florida, same thing everywhere. That's how they do it. They move from place to place, and use the same language, use the same political techniques. They're even trained in it. Organizers of the right wing are trained to do this. And who, Nadine, you've done quite a bit of work, I think, on who is behind this. Is this just spontaneous combustion by outraged citizens over 17 books?
No, this is a concerted, coordinated effort. In our last report, we called this a movement, and that's exactly what it is. You have several different groups that have formed that are sharing lists of books online. And Jim, as you note, they use the same language. They use the same typographical errors because they don't, it's not, as Emily said, this is not about the book. This is about,
what a coincidence.
It's about undermining, right? It's about undermining the librarians, the teachers, and in some cases, the officials who are running the schools. It's about imposing a particular point of view from a very few people and putting that and making that the point of view that everyone must adopt. It is using that perspective and taking and having the government do that work for them and say, we're just going to make this how we view things in this community, in this school district. And it's unfortunately it's been incredibly effective because we've seen now that this is happening. As I mentioned, it was in our last report, it was 32 states. We'll have new data coming out later this week, actually. And I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying that the numbers are continuing to grow. It really is, unfortunately, it really is expanding. So our report demonstrates that there is not only an increase in the numbers of books that are banned, but also an increase in the legislation that is being brought to bear. And that is really where it becomes an incredibly frightening, I think, trend, where you have legislative bodies who are coming in and saying, we are going to mandate this type of censorship And we're going to do so where they know that they are going after people with different identities, what they're going after with books that have a race component, that have characters who are primary characters of color, LGBTQ plus identities. What are we trying to do here? We're trying to erase, we're trying to diminish. And we're doing it with the hand of the government.
But yet the people themselves fight back against that. Llano,
we sure do.
Texas, yes. I've got a picture here of a demonstration out on a highway leading into Llano. And these are not left-wing hippies or any of the stereotypes of that the right wing would say would be opposed to their objections. Rather, here's a long, tall Texan with blue jeans and a denim shirt and a big old cowboy hat, just much like mine, holding a sign saying, "We heart our library." Here's a lady holding another sign, "Censorship is the child of fear and the father of ignorance." These are just local people, just as regular as you would ever want to see. And they're the ones who are standing up saying this is lunacy. And so when Nadine was talking about the groups that are orchestrating this attack, groups like Moms for Liberty. That's a sweet little name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Moms.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm always like, I'm a mom.
Wait a minute.
Also, and I'm in favor of liberty, too.
Wait a minute. So maybe you could be a member and vote the president out, I don't know. They claim, well, we're just a little group of moms, and we try to get together and do the right thing, the moral thing, to get the dirty stuff out of the library and get the controversial stuff out of the library. And we fund ourselves with t-shirt sales.
And brownies and lemonade.
Lemonade stands.
You had some experience with them, Nadine, yeah?
I do, actually. I had the honor of testifying before Congress a couple of weeks ago on a hearing that was... The title of the hearing was Free Speech and the Biden administration's, I think, attack on parental rights, something to that effect. But my testimony was about what's actually happening in terms of censorship, which is across the country at the state level and local level with these book bans. And one of my co-witnesses was a co-founder of Moms for Liberty. I think that the important thing here is the fact that their premise is we don't co-parent with the government. But that, in fact, is exactly what is happening. It is asking the government, again, to engage in censorship on behalf of a very small, ostensibly pretty vocal minority. We can talk about the euphemistic phrases and whatever that they're using. But the bottom line is that librarians and teachers that are selecting books for students are doing so because they have the professional training to do so. They have the background, they have the knowledge, they have...
We have master's degrees.
Master's degree, yeah, exactly.
It's our whole job.
Right, it's your whole job. And this is, it's trying to create this tension between teachers and parents and teachers and librarians, or excuse me, and parents and librarians, that somehow the information is going to poison the kids. Well, you know, that what poisons kids is not having access to any information and not being able to debate and understand and have perspective. That's what really, that's where the poisoning comes in.
And I also just like, we are library workers and teachers are also parents in the community. You know, we're not separate, but I do think it's really important to think about the library workers and the teachers who are on the front lines of these fights. You know, when you look at what happened to this librarian in Llano losing her job and, you know, talking to librarians here yesterday in Idaho, the fear is really intense. And so we've got the sort of legislative issues that we're talking about in terms of censorship, but also, you know, the temptation to simply not collect those materials, to hide those materials from our shelves, to take a library book about a gay person and check it out to mending and have it just sit off to the side and not include it in the collections, that is really intense. And so I think tying the anti-censorship work that we're all doing to workplace protections, I'm interested on the union side that, like, I need to have a structure in place that preserves my ability and capacity to work on behalf of my community without fearing that I will lose my job and health insurance, right? Yes. So we've got to be doing the work, I think, of tying the sort of spectacular book banning kind of moment to broader political movements about worker rights and worker power, because I should be able to do my job and trust that I will not lose my entire livelihood if I make sure that a gay kid in my school has a gay book to read about themselves. So that bigger movement piece, I think,
just
is really
sounds
important.
So silly when you say it out loud, right? Like, a gay kid might want a gay book to read. A straight
people
kid,
are,
I mean, like,
right?
You know, like,
but you know,
sorry,
as we say
sometimes
in the labor movement,
my head explodes again.
Right? It doesn't make any sense. But as we say in the labor movement, management is the best organizer, and they are working overtime. They're organizing everybody. Exactly. So I think it's actually a pretty, you know, could be an exciting moment.
And also, I'm impressed that you know, because they say we're defending our children, but the children seem to be okay with this. In Lano, again at the public testimony, a 10-year-old boy came forward and said, "It's not the county's job to burn the library down."
Wow, that's a great thing. You know, I think it's also really important to talk, I'm talking about the having a gay kid to have a gay book to read. It's also this idea that somehow reading begets indoctrination. No one reads Mein Kampf and says, "You know, that was a really great thing. I think I should go do that now." Nobody, yeah. we don't. We learn from things. And if it really was indoctrination, then all of the books that had been only about straight white people would have done what to be like, this is not, there is no logic here.
Didn't work with me. Look at me. Right.
So let's think about that.
Yeah. And the learning from history too, you know,
yes.
the what can we learn from how this has happened before? How are people organizing now and fighting back on this stuff? What are the, what lessons can we take from that and go forward? Emily, I think you had a story too. Louisiana, was it?
I mean, I've been talking to millions, like not millions, feels like millions, but my head is so full, but so many librarians and so many people around the country who are organizing, but there are great organizing stories happening all over the country. But one of my favorites is out of St. Tammany Parish in Louisiana, where a couple of activists who moved from New Orleans to St. Tammany wanted to have some LGBTQ plus friends. So they formed a social group called Queer North Shore. And Queer North Shore does all kinds of things. It has a family picnic. They organize the cubic pie float in one of the Mardi Gras parades. They do picnics, bars, roller skating night. But when they saw that what was happening to the library there, now St. Tammany is where Jeff Landry announced his tip line, right? Where you could, if you saw a librarian doing something bad, like giving a gay book to a gay kid, you could report
them.
So he launched that. You could rat him out. It's like we're in a bad, terrible movie. But anyway, he announces that in St. Tammany. So it's like very much the heart of the anti-book movement in Louisiana. But Queer North Shore has been organizing against that. They've pulled together people from all walks of life, not just queers, but the teachers and bankers and all the people that live in the community. Because remember, this is like everybody agrees with us. So they've organized everybody to go to the library board meetings and be real loud. They've produced overflow crowds. They just had a huge rally this weekend that was super exciting. And just getting everybody in the community to stand together against these censorship attempts and managed to keep a few books on the library shelf. They also, and this I didn't tell you when we were talking last week, they also at that rally announced that one of their organizers, Mel Manuel, is running for Congress for the first district in Louisiana, running on a campaign that I think is built in large part out of the activism and organizing work they've been doing around book bans. So just, I think in many places, you've got people pulling together. I'm really inspired by that. And I want to say one more thing.
Keep going.
The other sort of activist movement approach that I'm seeing is people who are organizing to take over their library boards.
Yes.
So that's a piece that the right has been doing really systematically, right? It's like they target these local bodies, not the right, but anti-censorship like groups. They target the library board. And if you run the library board, then you get to make some of those decisions. But in Lincolnwood, in Library District in the Chicagoland area, they, in response to... there was a movement to get against the library because they had a drag queen story hour where they read to the children the book, the drag queen's hips go swish, 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 right? Like really cute and fun, and everybody loved it. And then people sort of seized on that as a reason to organize against the library. But just last week, Lincoln Wood, they pulled together a slate of four pro-library anti-censorship candidates and managed to sweep the board elections with that slate. So making sure that we're not only sort of doing the work of rallies and legislative work and labor organizing and all the different pieces and parts, also making sure that we have actual power to make those decisions is another sort of piece of that, of the movement work that I'm seeing that I find really exciting and really important.
I agree. And let me just stress that a little bit by pointing out that most library boards are elected. You don't have to trust the establishment to appoint you to the library board. You can run for these offices, just a regular person. And they're open, they're winnable. Very few votes are cast in those races, which is how the right wing has taken over some library boards because, you know, they organize two churches and that's the constituents that vote. But we can do this, and that needs to be on the agenda of every community that values their library is take over the library board, and then you control it. And some right-wing lunatic nutball on the county commissioner's court can't undo it. We have the power as regular people, and that's the democratic possibility that is most encouraging. And I would just add one other little thing, another group, just speaking of fun, politics ought to be fun, not committee meetings. It ought to be exciting, you know, with a little bit of humor thrown into it. And so I like a group called the Freedom from Religion Foundation, and they have done a good job of explaining that perhaps the dirtiest, most pornographic book in the world is the Bible, and they have gone through the Bible and extracted. Actually, I have it right here somewhere. Extracted book by book, starting with Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, of course. That's full of stuff there. Right on down the line, all throughout it, some of the most graphic explanation. And the Freedom from Religion Foundation has issued warning labels that you can put in Bibles to warn you away from the pornographic possibility that might confront your head.
I think we can't get to the author of the Bible, but we certainly can get to the other authors who have been banned all across the country, the illustrators, the translators. Yes. You're talking just about 2,000 people here from our last report alone who have been affected by this. And I know they have been organizing. They've written letters to legislators. They've talked about this. They've had their parents go to school board meetings and talk. Maybe not ask them to, but their parents have been at school board meetings.
That was wonderful.
Wasn't that amazing? The George M. Johnson.
That was so brilliant.
She is truly remarkable. And look, the whole point about this is, if we have materials that are available, then we can contextualize them. We can teach them with sensitivity. We can teach them with a critical eye. And if you have access from a librarian or from a teacher, then you actually can get that context and that sensitivity and that critical eye. If you're going to download it on your phone or find it on the internet, you don't have that same kind of perspective and lens through which to understand and to learn. I mean, the kids are going to get it. The kids are going to get access to things. It's far better to have access from someone who is a professional, who is trained in and learning from these authors, who many times are putting out books about their own experiences because they didn't have that when they were growing up, and they want to offer it for kids now. And it's, I mean, I think that in and of itself is incredibly powerful.
Absolutely.
Indeed. Well, the fight does go on, and we're going to go on, but we want you to be a part of this fight. So connect with the American Library Association. Emily, what's the website there? I think it's pretty clear.
Yes, it's the ALA.org, but we'd also invite everyone to join us on our Unite Against Book Bans campaign, which has been pulling together national partners and individuals to organize for the right to read. And that's at uniteagainstbookbans.org, where you'll find data that you can use, talking points, templates for campaigns and letters. And I believe this podcast will be coming out during National Library Week. And so we've got activities that you can engage in the entire week, kicking off on Monday with our first Right to Read Day. And I think the best thing you can do during National Library Week and to show your support for the library, find a friend, find a family member, someone you work with, take them with you, go to the library, enjoy a program, check out a cake pan, some seeds, a book, tell your librarians how much you support them. The best thing we can do right now for our public institutions is to use them and use them as much as we can. And I'm just so thrilled to be able to join you here today and talk about the work the American Library Association is doing on behalf of readers everywhere. And that includes kids who have a right to a reading life as well.
And the beauty of it is that, well, there's a national organization. Go to your local public library and you can find out about all of these things and get active and make a difference. Nadine, tell us about how we link up with PEN America.
Yes, PEN America is at PEN.org, PEN.org. And if you go to our issue pages, the first thing you'll see is book bans. We have tip sheets for authors if your book has been challenged. We have tip sheets for students on how to fight book bans and for librarians if they're being harassed. And so please do use those resources, follow our data, use that information in your own community so that you can speak out and stand up for the books.
This is a way for grassroots America to stand against the powers that be who are trying to take away our basic freedoms. That's really what it comes down to, because they're not really banning books. They're banning you. They're banning us. And that's why we exist here on the Chat and Chew Roundtable, both as the Hightower Lowdown and the Hightower Lowdown Substack. Yes, you can be a part of our stack and stacking together. We can turn this thing around and let raise common sense to high levels. That's what we're about. Thanks for joining us today, and we look forward to the next session with you. And thanks to Emily and Nadine for the terrific work that they are doing. Glad to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.